You're listening to the replay of the Jabberjaw Show.
You're listening to Dominion Live Radio Network. Dominion Live Radio Network.
Tonight's Jabberjaw Show contains content that may be considered inappropriate for some listeners. Tonight's program is meant for a mature audience, and parental discretion is strongly advised.
That's right. We have Director Ryan Canton back on our annual traditional Halloween show. Ryan will be talking Shattered Hopes Part 3, amongst other things. My voice is a little raspy. It's still coming down from Brew Moon Fest 3 last week. Wow. But to kind of set the pace, I had to play you this news clip. From Fox 32 WFLD here in Chicago. This was done recorded earlier this week.
If someone died in your home, would you really want to know? One of the creators of a new website thinks you might, and they're doing the homework for you. Fox 32's Lisa Chavarria here with more. Lisa?
Well, Jeff, all you need is an address and $12 to search a home's history. It's something that Illinois and Indiana real estate agents don't have to tell you, whether or not someone died in the home you're about to buy.
God.
Would you really want to know what has gone on inside the home you're living in?
Yeah.
A new website is attempting to answer an eerie question. Has anyone died in your home, and how?
Of course, real estate says, you know, you should always disclose the truth and all of those things. And a lot of laws say, you know, if you know, you should tell. But no action can be taken against them for not telling.
Roy Condry is the co-creator of DiedInHouse.com. The website, for a fee, allows you to enter an address anywhere in the country, and it will inform you whether or not someone has died in that home.
There are probably 100 other things that I'd be a lot more concerned about.
Yeah, right.
Matt Farrell is the president of the Chicago Association of Realtors.
I'm guessing people die in their homes every day, so I'm not sure that's really a statistic that's all that interesting.
We went out to see if people were interested in finding out about their homes. So we visited a home on the city's south side where five people were killed nearly 25 years ago.
Never heard the story before.
Elena Ortiz is good friends with the woman that lives in the home, who declined to go on camera. She told us they've heard things when they've been in her friend's basement apartment.
I heard like footsteps that somebody walked through the living room to the kitchen.
Yikes.
But nobody's there.
There's that ghost aspect to it, if you're scared of ghosts or fear them, what have you.
Probably mice.
Or enjoy them, whichever you choose. Then there's the second aspect. It's, you know, you may not believe in that, but you just don't want the stigma.
A stigma can carry on even when no one has died in the home. This apartment building is where convicted serial killer John Wayne Gacy worked as a maintenance man.
Yikes.
Earlier this year, Cook County Sheriff Tom Dark came up empty-handed after a search for any additional victims. The apartment went on sale in March, and the owner decided not to relist it after only 3 months. Real estate agents do not have to disclose a home's history if it doesn't affect its value, like if someone died inside.
That is information that would impact my decision, and it would impact many other decisions, I believe.
At the end of the day, the buyers are looking to see what the home can be for them and what they can do with it moving forward, and it's not so much about who the previous owner was.
So a single search, like I told you earlier, would cost you about $12. But if you want to do more than that, you could search maybe up to 30 searches, and that would cost you about $270. Now, we asked you guys on Facebook if you would buy a house that someone has died in, and we're getting some very lively conversation. Now, Shanna says, I'm not sure if I could be completely comfortable or ever feel like it was my own. Lovato adds, this is a hard one to call. It would depend on the severity of the crime. If it were very violent, death, no. Now, Janelle says, I would, and just before I move in, I would have an exorcism just in case. There's so many people that are commenting about this.
You know, it's funny because it kind of goes both ways. For every person that would be uncomfortable in one of those situations, there are people out there that love that kind of thing, and that might attract them to the house.
Exactly.
As well.
So. And sometimes it can also save you on a little bit of money in the event that a person is trying to sell a house, can't do it for some time because of that stigma, and then the price will go down. So in the end, the buyer would win.
If you can live with it, you can get a good deal.
Exactly.
All right. Lisa, thanks. Darlene?
One of the Facebook comments down there just said, just have the house blessed when you move in anyway.
Yeah. You know, just... That is your public, or your Dominion Live Halloween public service announcement. In case you do move into a home that has some spiritual spiritual activity there. Just serving the community for you. That's our annual show. We got I broke out the apple cider, the Trader Joe's spiced apple cider. Maybe it'll do wonders for my throat, huh? let's try this. You gotta pick up a bottle of this. I'm telling you. I did this last year, too. I talked about this on our Halloween show. You gotta get a bottle of it, and then, put it in a coffee cup and microwave it for about 2 minutes, and it's like, fantastic. Nothing like hot apple cider on a cold fall day, huh? All right, last week we did the Brew Moon Fest 3, and I had to play a kind of a spooky song here from our friends Kickin' Jimmy right here on Dominion Live Radio.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming out to Brew Moon Fest number 3. We are thrilled to have you all here. We are more thrilled to raise a few dollars for a great, great organization, a great charity that does so much in our community. You might not even know what they do, but you should find out more about them. And that's the Greater LaGrange YMCA. We got a little silent auction raffle thing going on over for them, so please support them, because the programs they support are after-school programs, keeping kids safe. They support Special Olympics and dozens of other things. This bicycle riding around right here, this fat tire bike, could be yours if you stop by that table and buy a raffle ticket tonight.
Yeah.
The building might have sold. You might have read that in the paper, but the YMCA is going nowhere. They're going to be in our community. They're going to be helping us and making our place a better place for us to live continue in this community. So please support the YMCA.
You tell
Brew
us,
Moon
Steve.
4 is going to be October 18th, 2014, right here at the Max. I hope you'll all come back for that one. And I want to say a special thank you to an up-and-coming star, my friend's daughter, who I think is just absolutely amazing. Can you give one more round of applause for Josie Donna, that great performance? Josie, don't forget me, because you're going to be somebody someday. And I gave you this shot right here tonight. Remember that. We love Josie. Thank you so much, you guys. Thank you for coming. This next band's going to be awesome. But I'm going to let my friend, who's celebrating his 41st or 2nd birthday or something here, Brian, come out and introduce the next band. Thanks for being here. Let's rock out the rest of the night. Have a good time. Don't forget about the YMCA. We'll see you next year, October 18th. And by the way, in case you don't know, the Palmer family is celebrating 30 years of family open-operated business in downtown LaGrange. So we hope to see you all there drinking some of these great beers, because they're all available right there in downtown LaGrange at Palmer Place Restaurant. Thanks for coming tonight. Here's Brian.
Thank you, Steve. All right, these are my friends, Kick and Jimmy. Thanks for coming out, everyone, and supporting the Greater YMCA.
Woo!
Ready? Happy birthday, Brian.
Happy birthday.
Happy 33rd.
33rd, yeah. 43rd, actually, but that's cool. I'm still 33, yeah. I'm as young as I want to be. Spooky by Kickin' Jimmy right here on Dominion Live Halloween Special 2013.
In the cool of the evening when everything was getting kind of rude, I caught some plans for the night, and then you start and say, alright, love's kind of crazy with a sneaky little girl like you. You always keep me guessing, and never seem to know what you were thinking. If a fella likes it too, sure nothing I'm gonna be breaking. I get confused, cause I don't know where I stand. And then you smile and hold my hand. Love's kinda crazy with a spooky little girl like you. Oh, spooky, spooky. I'm gonna tell you all the little things my heart's been dying to be saying. Just like a ghost, you've been a haunting my dreams. So I propose on Halloween. Love's kinda crazy with a spooky little girl like you. Oh, spooky.
Never give up. Never surrender.
You can do it!
Oh, yes, we can. And yes, we will.
You think one man don't make a difference? Think again. Cause I just started an army picking up a pen. This begins a global collaboration to take the whole world and make for one nation. This ain't no imitation. What you're hearing is elite. That's why everything shocks when you hear us speak.
Oh, back to the mission at hand. We got a plan.
Take the message that we're sending. It's in black and white, it's been written, been read. Now let every single syllable settle into your head. As it slowly resonates from your mind to your feet, we'll make the earthquake from stopping this beat. Cause if you're hearing this right now, the battle's been won. It's spreading, my friend, the takeover has begun. This is our world, our streets, our war, our lives. This is what we fight for, our choice to make the wrong things right with our voice. This is our world, our streets, our war, our lives. This is what we fight.
All right, hang on, pal. Here we go. Except, hey, Ryan, what's happening?
Hey, Brian, how are you?
I'm doing great.
Good. Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween to you, too, pal.
One of our favorite times of year.
That's right. That's right. So what's been going on? This is Ryan Katzenbach, the Shattered Hopes guy.
The Shattered Hopes guy, yes. But probably not for very much longer.
Oh, okay. So I was...
We are gradually pulling our way, as you probably know, through the final installment of the Shattered Trilogy, and we're getting very close to being done. The film is pretty much completely cut, and it's just kind of going through the final mix process with audio and color correction and whatnot. And we've been waiting on some various and some materials to come in, and so it's just kind of been making its way through the system.
Cool. Cool. So when is this expected, when's the expected release? Uh-oh. Did I lose him? Uh-oh.
And there's been a holdup, and I won't really at this point go into what the holdup has been. It started about early to midsummer sometime, and it's kind of waiting on someone that we're trying to interview and someone that we're talking to, and we're kind of playing the waiting game with that. So we're down to the point where we need to basically close it up and release the film or do the interview, one of the two. And so we haven't even really committed to an exact release date yet, but we're definitely looking towards end of the year, very first of January sometime.
Okay. How did those now I sent you over a couple potential
leads. Yes, you did. They're working actually.
Good.
One of them is tied up due to some health issues. And we're hoping to catch up with them maybe towards the end of November. Like I said, the whole film is laid out. The whole film is done. We've got some spots reserved where we know that there are certain things that drop in when they get here. And so it's just kind of playing the waiting game on those. And then the other lead is looking pretty good as well.
Oh, okay, great. Great. I'm glad I was able to help you with that.
Yeah, I appreciate that. There was a lot of good info to be had from those individuals, and I think obviously we're dealing with the Amityville horror aspect, head on in this film. I think part three, I think each installment has picked up its pace. Obviously one of our hardest installments was part one, because that's where we're essentially setting up the story and we begin kind of poking holes at the official version and the way that things went down. And then we got to the second installment, and of course, that starts with the crime and goes through the investigation and the subsequent prosecution and all the way through the trial, ultimately to where we get to a verdict. So part three, it picks up the pace yet again, because we have a lot of ground to cover in the third installment. Obviously, we're picking up where we left off. We're going into the trial and the narrative behind the verdict and what happened. We've got a lot of ground to cover in the 20 years, 30 years since the event happened. Actually 20, 30, 40 years, there was a lot that went on in those intervals. So we're trying to kind of recap that. And then, of course, we've got to cover the Amityville horror aspect of it as well, because that's, the story that put this story on the map.
Yeah.
But then another huge part, the biggest part of part three, is really the forensic autopsy that we do of the DeFeo case. I believe we tear the case apart like no one else has ever done before. We go through every crime scene photo. We go through all of the various narrative reports. We go through the things like the autopsies, and we assemble what I think is the first complete picture of what really happened at 112 Ocean Avenue on the night of November 13th.
Okay. Okay, so
so there's a tremendous amount of ground to cover in part three yet.
Yeah, and so you got the starts out with the court, and then the forensic. Now, and then it goes into the now. I think maybe in the last year, I think the horror aspect. I think maybe that's picked up a little more, as far as hearsay.
You know, the story obviously refuses to go away.
Sure,
and there's another incarnation of it every around. I mean, you know, you had a documentary released in the past year, basically that deals with one of the Lutz boys, you know, claiming now that everything happened.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that you're going to hear, I think, a rather interesting narrative about that in the third installment of our film.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
And, you know, so that's kind of resurrected the interest. I don't know if you're aware of this or not, Brian, but there's actually, I think at this juncture, I want to say, I think there are three films in development on Amityville at this point.
I know there was that, Lost Tapes thing that was supposed to come out in January 13, and they delayed it to 2014. Now it's on delay again, from what I read.
You know, I had actually heard that about a week ago, that once again the thing has been pushed back and is on delay, and there's no expected release date of it. And what I had heard through the grapevine, and this is kind of unofficial, but what I had heard was that if you read the synopsis of the story, it's supposedly based sort of loosely upon the 1976 seance that was conducted by the Warrens, you know, at the insistence of the Lutzes.
Right.
And one of the reporters involved in that, a gal by the name of Laura DiDio, Laura DiDio, I guess from what I was told, and again, this is not official and I don't know exactly how accurate it is, Laura DiDio's story was essentially the one that was being depicted in Amityville, The Lost Tapes. It was like this fictionalized character was based on her, and it was telling the story about these lost tapes that supposedly surfaced at some point. Obviously, another fictional version of the Amityville horror.
Sure.
And what I was told was that there was some litigation threatened, or the hint of litigation, or something along those lines, by this individual who said, wait a minute, that's my story, you can't tell that. So I don't know if they're trying to retool Amityville, The Lost Tapes, or exactly what they're doing, to be honest with you, nor do I really care. And, you know, there's another company, there's talks that the company that made The Conjuring, which was a huge success over this past summer, which is based on the Warren's book, The Demonologist.
Sure.
There's talks that they're going to come out with an Amityville-related movie or something related to the Warren's case files. We really don't know what that's going to be, but it'll be another, you know, Amityville. If they do something, it'll be just another Amityville haunted house story.
Yeah.
And then there's another company that's got another Amityville project in development. And then a couple of months ago, what was really interesting was Ed Asner told me that another producer had approached him and asked him if he would be involved in some sort of Amityville horror spinoff kind of thing. So literally, Brian, the story, as long as Hollywood is able to make a dollar off of it, they will just keep perpetuating this entire hoax, which that's all it is. It's just a fraud as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
And I think that once you see part three and you sort of see the way that the chronology of the story, and you sort of understand the way that this thing was kind of woven together, you know, I think that by the time you get done, I would hope that the logical person understands this was a commercialized venture right from the start. You know, Ed and Lorraine Warren, in my opinion, you know, and I think it'll be the opinions of a lot of people after they see this, it'll be clear that they were brought in from the beginning to sort of verify, you know, that the events that happened during the Lutz's 28 days did actually happen, you know. Mm. So on the beat, as we say, the beat goes on.
yeah, and it, you know, you look at the Warrens and everything they touch, it's... Everything they touch ends up, there's litigation of fraud in everything. There hasn't been one case filed that had people go, oh, well, wait.
Exactly. And the Lutzes, and of course, George Lutz was no different, right. You know, because I think everything, I mean, he sued Bill Weber sued him. Of course, that was some rather messy litigation in front of Judge Weinstein in New York. And then a few years later, Dino De Laurentiis, you know, made Amityville to The Possession, which was the pre-movie to the Amityville Horror.
Yeah.
And I think that lawsuit, Lutz actually sued Dino De Laurentiis over using the name Amityville and tried to basically assert that he owned that name and no one could use it. And he tied Dino De Laurentiis up for something like 12 years in court or something like that. Of course, then at one point he sued his stepson, Christopher Quarantino, over stuff that Christopher was saying or whatever differences they had. He sued Rick Osuna. He sued Lou Gentile, the radio host. Then he sued MGM and Dimension Films over the Amityville Horror remake. You know, if you want to know what goes on in terms of the Amityville franchise, you basically just need to look at a court docket.
Yeah, it even sounds like pretty suit crazy. I mean,
yeah.
He couldn't have won any of those cases. He doesn't have the right. He doesn't own the rights to the word Amityville, does he? No, absolutely not.
You know, Amityville is basically a public domain name,
sure,
that anybody can use. There's a village named after it. If Lutz owns the name Amityville, it raises the question: can Amityville call themselves Amityville?
Yeah. Next thing he's going to do is
like as a classic example, and we've probably touched upon this in previous interviews. You know, I remember back in 2003 or 2004, whenever it was, you know, Rick Osuna had gotten in touch with me, and he said, you know, I just got served by George Lutz. And, of course, the very first thing that I thought was, okay, Lutz is suing over something that Rick said in the book. He's suing for libel or defamation or something along those lines because, you know, Rick's book pretty much did spell out that he believed that the story was an elaborate hoax. And then when I got the lawsuit and I read the lawsuit, it turned out to be absolutely, it did not involve the book in any way or anything that Rick wrote in the book. Instead, it was over a business deal gone bad between Lutz and Osuna several years earlier, you know. And so at the end of the day, we fought that lawsuit, and that thing basically got thrown completely out. Four of five of Lutz's causes of action were dismissed on summary judgment. You know, so Lutz hasn't had a very good track record, you know, before he died, obviously.
Mm.
He didn't have a very good track record of suing and actually winning anything.
Seems to want to sue anyone who goes against anything he has to say. Yeah.
Well, and you know, Brian, that was what happened essentially with Rick Osuna. You know, Rick Osuna at multiple times throughout the suit, and you know, I've got a paper trail of emails a mile long that back up all of this stuff. Rick had tried to do things to placate Lutz and tried to settle the lawsuit. You know, one of Lutz's claims was that Rick had the AmityvilleHorror.com as a domain name, and Lutz claimed that infringed his trademark. So he demanded that Rick turn over, as a condition of settling the suit, he said, you need to turn that domain name over to me. So, of course, Rick turned him over, AmityvilleHorror.com or AmityvilleHorror.com, whatever it was. He turns the domain over, and as soon as he gets done turning the domain over, in good faith that they're going to resolve this lawsuit, Lutz comes back and says, oh, just kidding, I didn't mean I would settle it, and he drags it out in court and files some more actions against Osuna. You know, so, you know, that's been the type of character that we dealt with in George Lutz for quite a while, and, you know, obviously, I think that speaks for itself.
Wow. it says, I mean, it just kind of proves what kind of guy, person he was. I mean,
well, and he would write, and one of the things, and we've got these letters too, you know, he would have his attorney write Rick these letters, and these letters would tell Rick Osuna, I will own you, you know, and that, I mean, we've got several of those letters, and that right there speaks volumes. But, you know, really what Lutz wanted, and I think it was perfectly clear to all of us when we were working on this, was he was going to do anything he could to push Rick Osuna out of the Amityville business. He wanted Rick to turn over the night that the Feos died to him. He wanted Rick's website. He wanted all of these things to make sure that Rick Osuna would not have a voice in the Amityville, you know, franchise. And that was very important to, obviously, to anybody who's trying to make sure that that franchise lives on and does not want anyone to hear an alternate point of view.
Yeah, that's pretty twisted. Yeah. Wow.
So, well, it's been a, this story has been a pretty dark decade of my life, and
I bet you're,
needless to say,
you can't wait to get over.
I think I know what you're going to say. I think you're glad that it's almost done, and yes, I am very glad that it's almost done.
So what are you working on now? You have another project you're working on.
We have another documentary that we started. It's really funny the way that the new documentary came about was in 2000, in November of 2010, Hollywood publicist Ronnie Chasen was on her way home from the premiere of the movie Burlesque. And I don't know if you know a lot about Ronnie Chasen and who she was, Brian.
No.
But she was a publicist. She pretty much represented, she didn't really represent like A-list talent like Brad Pitt or George Clooney or someone like that. She was kind of a gal who was very successful in her business, and she represented a lot of filmmakers and composers. She represented Dick and Lily Zanuck, who made movies like Driving Miss Daisy. She represented Hans Zimmer, who was a composer on, I think he just did Inception here recently, and he's quite an A-list composer. And she had been to the premiere of the movie Burlesque in Hollywood on November 15th, 2010. And they went to the after party at the W Hotel on Hollywood Boulevard. And just after midnight, Ronnie leaves the hotel and goes down Sunset and is on her way home to her Westwood condo. And she gets to the corner, goes the official report. She gets to the corner of Sunset and Whittier. And while sitting at the intersection, someone comes up and puts a gun to the passenger window of the car and shoots her five times.
Jeez.
So she makes a left turn. She drives down Whittier and she loses control. It's roughly about a quarter of a mile down the street from where she shot. She loses control and hits a concrete post. And of course the police come. She's transported to the hospital and pronounced dead about 40 minutes later. And so for 2 weeks after the murder happens, the Beverly Hills Police Department is working to try and develop a lead in the case. And they basically came up with nothing. There was nothing basically wrong in her look. You know, she was not the subject of lawsuits. She didn't have any jilted ex-lover, ex-boyfriends who wanted to kill her. Her business was straight as an arrow and clean as could be. And so this really made no sense. They got a tip from America's Most Wanted, and America's Most Wanted revealed that this guy by the name of Harold Smith was supposedly the guy who, on a bicycle, came up to her car, tried to rob her, and when the robbery went wrong, he shot her 4 to 5 times. And when the police went to question him in Hollywood, they walked in and they announced themselves to him when he came walking into the building and at the Harvey Apartments on Santa Monica Boulevard. And when he came walking in, they announced themselves, and he pulled a gun out of his pocket at that point and shot himself in the head, committing suicide. So about 6 months later, Beverly Hills Police Department concluded that the gun that Harold Smith used matched the ballistics of the bullets that were used on Ronnie Chasen, and in July of 2011, the case was rubber-stamped closed. So that's the background of what we're working on now.
A lot simpler than Amityville, isn't it?
Well, one would think that was actually the initial thought going in, was that, you know, this is a cut and dried murder. Harold Smith obviously did this, you know, it was a robbery gone bad, and you sort of walk in, you know, believing that it is what it is. So far, it hasn't been what they said that it's supposed to be. And there's a lot more questions that are out there than what we have answers for at this point. And the police are doing, I'm seeing so many similar things between Beverly Hills and Suffolk County that it's a very interesting parallel, because it's like, whoa, what case am I working on?
Yeah. Wow. And when do you expect that project to be completed?
Oh, we are probably a good year and a half on that one at this point. You know, we started, what actually happened, Brian, was, you know, we released right around that part two was coming out. We were rolling into part three of Amityville Hot and Heavy last fall. Huh. And so I started thinking, okay, part three is going to wrap up within 8 to 9 months. I should start lining up a project now, you know, and I'd been following Ronnie Chasen's story since the day it happened. So I thought, okay, I'll start investigating this to see if there's a story here. And so I start reaching out to some various people and whatnot. And before I knew it, Brian, this thing took off. And of course, I'm sitting here and I'm not done with Amityville, and now I've got this full-scale train wreck that is Ronnie Chasen going on over here on the side. So this last, like, 6 or 8 months has been kind of interesting. It's literally been, you take one phone call or answer one email dealing with Amityville, and the next phone call or email deals with Ronnie Chasen. And so you're kind of juggling the two of them in the air at the same time, and it's kind of slowed things down a little bit.
Wow. Yeah, it'd be like... Yeah, you know, be careful not to mix the two up. You can get all those emails.
Well, yeah, exactly. They, you know, you kind of sit back sometimes and you're like, okay, what am I doing? Like, a couple of weeks ago, it was like, what am I doing this weekend? I'm supposed to be in edit session on part three of the film, but yet I got caught and I have to go to L.A. to take care of something, you know, in town for a couple of days. So you're shuffling the projects around, trying to figure out how to take care of all of them all at one time. So it's been a little challenging.
Huh. How's the book coming? I know you're working on putting together a book.
Well, the book, you know, the book is one of those labors of love where, you know, it's kind of fun to tell the story behind the making. Of course, the book you're referring to is on the making of Shattered Hope.
Yeah.
And the whole, you know, 7-8 year odyssey that it took to make the film and kind of what you go through while making an independent film. I write it sort of in spurts, you know. As of probably 6 months ago, it was completely current. In other words, I would write right up to the point where I was at. So I would have the book done from beginning to where I'm at. And then, you know, 6 more months goes by, or 3 months goes by, and I don't touch it again, and a lot more happens. So you have to kind of go back and look at your notes and look at your journal and kind of regroup and begin catching up to it and writing. So probably by the time that part three of the film is done, the book itself will probably be ready within 6 months after that.
Huh. Cool. A box set?
Yeah. There's a lot going on.
Yeah. How about the Shattered box set? How's that coming? You guys going to be doing a box set?
Well, you know, that's like the million-dollar question is the box set. And if I do a box set, you know, I can't say if we do a box set, you know, I want to make sure that box set is really dynamic and really good.
Yeah.
And my biggest concern about the box set is having the time to go back through 100+ hours of tape and look at everything and pull off all those bonus features and all that extra material to really make that box set substantial and very worthwhile. Otherwise, if you don't do that, what's the point of doing a box set?
Sure.
So it's kind of up in the air as to when a box set would be released, if a box set will be released. But it's definitely on the radar screen.
Any of the part one, part two, are those going to be available at the local, your local stores or anytime soon?
Well, at this point, I don't know. And the reason that I don't know is, you know, obviously we sell part one and part two on our website,
mm-hmm.
and we also sell it through Amazon. And it's all on demand on Vimeo, and you can get part one on Amazon on demand. And the big thing is, Brian, we haven't really pushed trying to get it into any mainstream outlets, like say a Walmart or a Target or one of the big guys, or even a Barnes and Noble for that matter, because we don't have really a full set, and we've always felt that the set, that the series, the trilogy, becomes far more viable once you have the whole thing.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The plan is to kind of get a little bit more aggressive with distribution plans once we have that third installment wrapped up and done.
Okay. Now, how are the Soulfix? Oh, that's a good question. Did you ever get your gun back?
We never got the gun back, and I highly doubt that we ever will.
Ugh.
You know, I think that gun is probably buried somewhere in a box or in an evidence locker or God only knows where, probably in the back of some detective's drawer, and they've probably forgotten about it by now. And
they,
you know,
probably threw it back.
I'm very disappointed.
You know what they did? They probably threw it right back in the river where you found it.
probably so. That's what I would want to do with it. You know, the thing about the gun that disturbs me, and I know we've talked about this at various times in the years that we've been talking and doing interviews about the film and whatnot, the thing that bothers me about this is that my research, as you're going to see, the gun is a chunk of, not a major chunk, but a good-sized chunk of part three of the forensic analysis. You know, and I think that the view that our research and our findings and everything that we came across while we were investigating, we put our research right out there in the film. Okay, this is why we connected the dots. This is how we connected the dots. This is how we came up with the thesis that there was a gun there in the canal to begin with. Okay, so our research is on the table. We can say, this is how we found it. This is why we found it. For Suffolk County Police to come back, Brian, and say, oh, the gun's not connected to DeFeo, okay, it completely shows a lack of any scientific information on their end.
Yeah.
You know, here we are stating our case and showing why we believe it was connected, and they simply dismiss it. I think that when that plays out in front of an audience, I think that maybe we don't even need the gun back, frankly, because it almost answers the question in and of itself by them refusing to deal with it.
Yeah, it's kind of, like what, I have said this before, what are they hiding? Why bury the gun? If you don't have anything to hide, you know, then...
Well, exactly. And I mean, and the thing is that, you know, the gun, and I'm sure, again, we've said this before, the gun, we can't prove what the gun is or isn't, obviously. Okay?
Right.
We don't know whether the gun was a .32 or a .38, since the chassis that we recovered was commonly used for both calibers of gun. Okay, we don't have a barrel, we don't have a chamber, and even if we did have a barrel and a chamber, after 38 years, 39 years, 37 years, whatever it was, underwater, you're not going to be able to get any forensic info off of that gun as far as the rifling or the ballistics, okay?
Sure.
So we'll never be able to prove for sure what it was, but I think that it's very interesting that when you put all of these things together and you connect all these dots and you say that there is a gun out there in the canal and then you find it exactly where you thought it would
be,
and you've got all of these witness statements that substantiate that there was the presence of a .38 handgun, that you got one of the detectives in part two saying, we knew that there was a second gun, we heard that there was a second gun, and we never made any attempt to find it, I think it becomes pretty evident that Suffolk County just wants this whole thing to go away. That, you know, what I, where I started to go with this was, we have not heard them, and they have not cleaned, to our knowledge, they have not cleaned the gun up in any way and tried to get any of the layers of gunk off of it. We have no idea if, even in the absence of a barrel or a chamber, we have no idea if there's a serial number on that gun. You know, it's like I said from the beginning, if you guys can say that it's not connected to DeFeo, and you can bring that gun back and you can say, okay, we found markings that prove that this gun was made in 1984, I will gladly accept those findings as being the truth. I will gladly accept that and say, okay, that proves that the gun was not used in the commission of the DeFeo crimes. But in this particular case, Suffolk shoves it in the back of a desk drawer and says, it's not connected to DeFeo, and it's not connected because we say so.
The reality is like when you're reality is what we decide it is.
That's exactly it. You will be spoon fed. We will spoon feed you what we want you to think and what we want you to know. I mean, to this day, Brian, I still laugh. You know, when I think it was CBS did that segment on the air, and the detective sits there and in response to our discovery, he says, "Well, I think it's very interesting that some people can find stuff on the internet and assert things as fact that aren't fact." And I sat there and I yelled at the TV screen and I said, we didn't get something off the internet and asserted as fact. We got it out of your files. These are your homicide files that we got this info out of.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, and that's it. Their own files substantiated the search for this gun and made that happen. Otherwise, we probably wouldn't have looked there.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was another thing. You did an interview, now was that CBS, that was CBS in Los Angeles, right?
As far as that segment was actually produced by CBS out of New York.
Okay.
And I appeared on the segment via satellite from Los Angeles.
Okay, now if you go onto the internet, onto that website, or... You watch it online. I think you have a link up on the Amityville documentary website.
Right.
It only plays like it plays maybe 5 minutes of it, and then it shuts down. I can't watch the whole thing. I don't know what. I've never seen the entire piece.
Interesting, because last I had seen it, it played all the way through, and it was fine. But I guess we'll go back and we'll take a look at that and see. If that is the case, because what we may want to do is, I think somewhere around the office, I've actually got a DVD copy of that segment, and if that's the case, we can always post that to a YouTube channel or whatever. In fact, Brian, I think that there have been some other people who have posted that CBS segment on YouTube. I think you can find the whole thing floating around out there.
Oh, okay. Because I was like, it gets right to like a cliffhanger part, and it shuts down. And I'm thinking, why is that? Isn't that convenient for someone who didn't want the truth out?
Well,
you know,
it's Jody the pig. You know, anything that goes wrong, we blame it on Jody the pig.
I agree. It's a stinking pig, playing in the mud and popping his eyes in windows and all that crazy. It was
exactly,
a cat. Actually, it was just neighbor's cat.
Pig.
It was the neighbor's kitty cat, that's all.
Exactly. And the cat's name was actually, believe it or not, the cat's name was Evan Rude. And the cat, as we discussed this actually in part three of the film, you know, Evan Rude was, maybe you know this, maybe you don't, I don't know, but you know, the genesis of the pig. Okay, do you know that story, Brian, how the pig came to be?
No. Yeah, sure.
Well, the story goes that the neighbors, the Irelands, had a cat, okay, and the cat's name was Evan Root, and the cat was a Siamese cat. And the Siamese cat is the only cat whose eyes glow red in the dark.
Oh, great.
And the cat used to scale the lattice work on the side of the house. Now, this is what's been said, so who knows, you know, who knows if this is the gospel truth or not. But the cat supposedly scaled the lattice work on the side of the house, and it would stare in the window of the house on the second floor. And Butch DeFeo hated the cat, and he would say, that blankety-blankin-effin-pig-cat is looking in my window again. And at that point, apparently Bill Weber relayed that story to George and Kathleen Lutz when they were cooking up this book deal for what was originally a book to be written by Bill Weber. And so that became the genesis in the Amityville Horror for the demonic pig. And of course, the pig has long been associated with Satanists and the occult. And of course, then we have the time of, as we will deal with extensively in part three of the film, we talk extensively about the DeFeo's actual time of death. And the actual time of death, you know, they say is obviously 3:15 a.m. Okay, and that's when, in the Amityville Horror, George Lutz wakes up every night at 3:15 a.m., and of course, that's when the front door is ripped off of its hinges from the inside of the house to the outside of the house, and he wakes up to the marching band that's going down the hall and all of these other crazy occult things that supposedly happen.
He's put down a peace pipe.
When we break it down in the film, you know, you begin to realize that 3:15, you know, 3:15 is used in certain religious beliefs. It's a basically a mockery of the time that Jesus died on the cross, which is said to be around 3 p.m. in the afternoon. So that was why 3:15 became a convenient time for this to happen. In reality, as we will demonstrate through numerous witness statements on Ocean Avenue that night, the DeFeos were not killed at 3:15 a.m. Okay, absolutely did not happen.
No, I didn't. You know, I didn't think that. I just kind of always figured George had his, you know, he had that old school 70s clock. He never plugged it in. It was always at 3:15. So of course he woke up at 3:15.
3:15 every single night. Yeah, yeah, look at that. How do you account for that? It's 3:15 again.
Yeah, 3:15 again. Yeah. Oh, maybe if I plugged it in. Oh, it wasn't plugged in. Oops.
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things that I thought was really, really interesting was Lorraine Warren did an interview in, I believe it was 2002, on the Lou Gentile Show. And she actually went on, if I remember right, she went on with George Lutz. They were both on the show. And she made a number of very interesting statements that those clips appear now in part three of the film. And I won't give it away, and I won't spoil where we're going. But they are complete contradictions in one case, and they certainly prove our point about the Amityville Horror being a setup in yet another, you know. And, you know, it's very telling, it's very interesting when you hear these words spoken by the person who was there, and then you weigh them against the testimony and the words of others, you begin to clearly see, when it's delineated in this linear fashion, you begin to see how this whole story really took off.
Yeah, fraud. Fraud, money,
grubbers. Fraud.
Fraud and money grubbers.
Fraud and money.
Yeah. So how's the TV dealing with you? How's that working for you? The A&E networks and all those, because I know you had problems with them before.
Well, we have literally not gone back to any of the networks. We haven't done anything with any of the networks. We haven't pitched any of the networks. We've got some interest on Ronnie Chasen, and who knows whether that will materialize or not. But we've also got some interest in a theatrical release for Ronnie Chasen as well. So, you know, it is what it is. The thing to me in dealing with Amityville in particular with the networks is that no one is interested in telling the true story behind what really happened. you know, the interest lies in the haunting. If we were walking in and we said at the, if we walked in and we said at the end of Shattered Hopes, at the end of the trilogy, we will conclude that George Lutz was telling the truth and that the house was haunted and that Jody the demonic pig tripped the mailman on the doorstep and that Jody ripped the door off the hinges and that Jody did all of these things and that the house was really haunted and slime oozed from all of the windows and the doors, we would probably more than likely get a deal with one of the networks.
Oh, I'm sure.
You know, we would probably get Shattered Hopes on the air. But when we walk in and we say, we're doing a documentary about a haunted house that is unhaunted, they just turn their noses up at it, and they're not interested in hearing about it because that does not get ratings. It's the truth, but it does not get what they want. It does not do what they want. And right now, as I think you probably know, you know, the paranormal thing is a huge angle right now.
Apparently,
I mean,
yeah.
Everywhere you, every channel, every network has a, you know, some sort of paranormal ghost hunter show. And what when you talk to real paranormal, I mean, credible paranormal psychologists,
like Barry Taft,
they all turn their nose up and they all, yeah, exactly. They all turn their nose up and they all laugh at these shows because the thing about these shows is they've got to go out every single week and they've got to find a haunted house. They've got to go find a ghost in a hiding in a closet or a basement somewhere. And that is, the reality of that is it's not the case. You know, it's like one, in fact, it was Barry Taft that said to me, you know, the odds of finding a haunted house, a real manifestation, a real haunted house, is like winning the lottery.
Yeah.
You know, and so most of what I think we see on television in terms of, you know, these ghost hunting shows, it, to me, it's a fraud.
Yeah, I agree. The Sci-Fi Channel and, yeah, every show on that thing is that they, let's spin off Ghost Hunters International, Ghost Hunters International. You know, just,
right,
oh,
right.
Sorry.
Ghost Hunters, it's Ghost Hunters Arkansas, you know, I mean, it's, you know, but you know what, Brian, it's not just that, really, it's not just that. It's the networking, it's the networks and the development people in general, okay?
Yeah.
I mean, the I get very frustrated with it because, you know, the thing is it seems like nobody is able to come up with original programming anymore.
Oh,
you know,
if one
network has, you know, a pawn shop series, you know, has Pawn Stars, for instance, immediately within 6 months, every network has got another angle on the pawn shop or the storage units. And then this whole Duck Dynasty thing, I don't even remotely get it at all. What that whole thing is about.
I don't either.
You know, and it's just,
I can't stand to watch it.
I think that the American people, I don't know anymore. I mean, I thought at one time that I had a good sense of what the American people liked and what they would buy into, but anymore, I don't know. I mean, because I look at this stuff and it's just like, wow, you know. But I mean, In the meantime, we're just going to stay the course and we're just going to keep doing what we do, which is, I feel, developing, you know, intellectual properties that are intellectual, you know, dealing with properties that are stimulating, that are interesting, that are fact-based, that tell the truth behind stuff, because we do have a good following of people that believe in our work and believe in what we do, and that's really, honestly, that's the group of people that I prefer to cater to.
Sure. And I have an idea, a good show idea for Sci-Fi Channel that I know they haven't thought about.
It's not going to be Amityville the Musical, is it?
Though that was one. How about Ghost Hunters, Ghost Hunters in Space? Yeah. There you go.
God. Well, it hasn't been done yet, but yeah, I think what you should do if you're actually going to pitch that is, I think you should make the pitch kind of like ghost hunting in a pawn shop or ghost hunting in a storage unit, you know, kind of thing. You get the best of all worlds. The guy who goes in and buys the storage unit and finds it packed full of goblins and ghouls. Now, that, to me, that would be the best of all worlds.
South Park did a good parody of Ghost Hunters. I don't know which season it was, but they Ghost Hunters go into the house, and the guy's like, "Hey, I feel something wet coming down my pants. Oh, my God, what is it? Oh, I'm peeing myself. Oh, Jesus." They run out.
Well, I was going to say, actually, South Park does pretty much a good parody of everything.
They do. Yeah, so I'd like to see a South Park parody of Amityville. That would be good. Blood coming out.
That would actually be good. That would be very worth watching.
Yeah. So what do you got planned for Halloween, Ryan, this 2013?
Very little. Very little. It's a good night, as far as I'm concerned, to stay in.
Yeah, right. See what kind of paranormal TV they got on.
We usually end up doing something family related. Back in my younger days, I used to go to a Halloween party, or I used to be out on the town or doing something. And I don't know, the last really 8 or 10 years, I don't really get into it all that much, frankly. It's just, let's just stay at home and light a pumpkin and stare at it.
Yeah, right. Yeah, well, hey, Ryan, it was good having you on this Halloween again.
Absolutely, Brian. It's a tradition that we proudly continue every year and look forward to it.
Sure.
And thank you for having us on. Do you have another guest tonight?
No, I don't. It's just tonight was you, and I'm thinking of another Halloween show, but I'm having trouble getting a hold of these people. So,
gotcha.
Yeah, I can't think of their names.
Well, good luck with that, and I'm pleased that we were able to continue the tradition this year.
Yeah. Oh, were you able to get the I know the question. Were you able to get the Fails pants out of the Suffix? Were you able to find? 'Cause I don't remember. Remember, we were looking for the clothes.
The refresh me on this. Why is this not coming to the top of my mind?
Okay. Well, the last time you were trying to get DeFeo's pants and his shirt out of the Suffolk County lockup from.
As far as I know, at last check, they are still there. And we were going around at one time. We were going around with trying to get
forensic purposes.
Suffolk County to open up. We wanted to actually open up the bags that had the clothes that the DeFeos were wearing. There were certain victims we wanted to see the clothes laid out.
Yeah.
And we also wanted to see the clothes that DeFeo was wearing that night with regards to some blood staining that was supposed to be on it. And Suffolk County pretty much put their foot down and said, that's not going to happen, but they do still have the stuff. So who knows, maybe in the aftermath of Part 3, they will be forced to do a little bit of DNA testing on that stuff. You never know.
Yeah. Well, okay, Ryan, you have yourself a great Halloween. I know it's kind of a shorter interview, but we're at Part 3. Yeah. So I mean, look at the interviews. We used to go on for 2 hours because we were at Part 2 and we were talking about, you know, murder, mayhem,
right?
And
right.
You know, so this is probably
mob, and don't forget the mob.
Oh, the mob. Yeah, yeah.
There's going to be a lot. I think you're going to find that having seen Part 1 and then having seen Part 2. When you get to Part 3, I think every dangling thread from Parts 1 and Part 2, I think we've done a very good job of tying off.
Uh-oh. Still there? Oh, no. Ryan?
All of our research to everything that's gone on, you know, at the end of Part 3.
Could you repeat that? Because we lost you there for a second. Oh. Ryan?
Are you there?
Yeah, we lost you there for a second.
Okay. Well, you went silent all of a sudden, so that was probably my connection. But I was just saying that I think when you see part three, I think that it will wrap up everything that was in one and two very nicely and bring it all home.
Yeah. Okay. Well, looking forward to that in January, huh?
Yeah, probably, possibly before, but more than likely, probably right around the first to middle of January, sometime right in there. Yeah.
I'll tell you what, when this is all wrapped up, we'll bring it back on in January.
Sounds like a plan. We'll look forward to it.
All right, buddy. Thanks for coming on, man.
Brian.
It wouldn't be Halloween without you on this show.
It wouldn't be Halloween without doing the show.
Thanks. All right.
You got it. Have yourself a good Halloween, and I'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, and I'll post this stuff up on Facebook for you.
Sounds like a plan.
Okay. Take care, bud.
Okay. Yeah, be well, Brian.
Yeah,
thanks.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. All right. There's Ryan Katzenbach for our Halloween Hootenanny for 2013. Let's play. I'll be heading on out there. But before we exit, I have to play some more Halloween music here. Just one little quick one. What is it? Oh, Superstition. Yeah, well, you know, I'm going to go ahead and leave you here with Superstition by Josie Dunn. Everyone have a safe Halloween. You guys have a great weekend. I hope you appreciate it, and enjoy tonight's show. Josie Dunn, local girl here in LaGrange, from last week's Brew Moon Fest. Jamming. She was really good, man. We're going to get her on the show, too, coming up. I think, you know what? I don't have a date set for that, but we'll have to work on that. All right? You guys take care. Talk to you on the flip.
We have a special guest here tonight. He's going to be performing for the next 45 minutes or an hour or so, whatever. However we want to do it. Josie Dunn, she's a local here from LaGrange. I think she's got some fans already. And you haven't even heard her sing yet. Watch out. Recent winner of the Pillars Song Contest, right? Yeah?
The what?
The Pillars? Recently. Yeah, she won that. She's really, really talented. We are lucky that she came out here tonight to treat us all. Some of her homegrown music here. So give it all up for Josie Dunn.
Thank you.
Very superstitious, writing on the wall. Very superstitious, ladder's about to fall. 13-month-old baby broke the looking glass. That's 7 years of bad luck, the good things in your past. When you believe in things that you don't understand, then you suffer. And superstition ain't the way. Oh, every superstition, wash your face and hands to rid me of the problem. Do all that you can to keep me in a daydream, ooh, and keep me going strong. Oh, if you don't wanna save me, then sad is my song. When you believe in things that you don't understand, then you suffer. And superstition ain't the way. Oh, every superstitious, there's nothing more to say. And very superstitious, ooh, the devil's on his way. 13-month-old baby broke the looking glass. 7 years of bad luck. The good things in your past. When you believe in things that you don't understand, then you suffer. Superstition ain't the way. Superstition ain't the way, baby. Ooh, ooh, yeah. No, 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 no. Oh, you believe in things that you don't understand, and you suffer. Superstition ain't the way.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Cheers, and happy Halloween, everyone.